It's the Burt Cohen Show. And there's been a lot of great American history of which we can be proud. The, labor unions, the folk tradition, our arts and culture. There's an awful lot about America that we really need to learn from, stuff that we really don't really want to look at. And for a lot of people who have been involved in American history, they've had no choice but to look at it. You know how sometimes you don't choose a life kind of chooses you, and you make something really great from that. And I'm very, very pleased and honored to have as a guest today somebody who has been working on an issue that happened to him when he was just 6 years old. Well, it happened to his parents, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, back in 1953. I'm pleased to have a guest on the Burt Cohen Show today, Robbie Meeropol. Thank you so much for being with us from Western Mass today. Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit technologically challenged here. I tried to mute the phone so it wouldn't ring in the background, and instead I muted my own voice.
Ah.
So we may hear a telephone ring. I apologize in advance, but at least you'll hear me.
Well, that's good, and join the technologically challenged club, those of us above the 6-0 mark, 20th century people, and at least if we hear the phone ring, it's probably people who want to help the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and we will get to talk about that, talk about making something really good out of something really bad. Well, you've been through this a million times, and I appreciate you doing it again, and but specifically 60 years ago, February 25th, 1952, what happened then? How was it significant in the life of you and your parents and the United States?
Well, that was the date in which my parents' trial court conviction for conspiracy to commit espionage, which had occurred almost a year earlier, was upheld by the Second Circuit, the United States Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And, you know, as somebody who had this happen to him, I was, as your introduction quite aptly put, that I was born into this, I find myself almost every 10 years now going through this sort of anniversary cycle. That starts with the 60th anniversary of my parents' arrest, and ends with in this particular 10-year decade, ends with the 60th anniversary of my parents' execution in June of 2013. And this date that just occurred was a very important milestone because my parents had appealed their conviction. And the court upheld the conviction below. So it was a major step on the road to their ultimate execution.
And the charge, well, they were charged with one thing, and it seems to me like they were executed kind of for something else. They were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, I believe. What does this mean in terms of seriousness to those charged?
Well, it's one of the curious things about the case, and that is that if you read about it in the newspapers, my parents are almost always referred to as being convicted of espionage or treason.
Right.
When in fact they weren't. But that's what the case was sort of moved to in the public mind. My parents were actually charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. That basically means two or more people got together and plan to commit espionage. The government doesn't even need to prove that they succeeded in that plan. And the words atomic bomb never even show up in their indictment. And yet, in the public mind, they were known as the atomic spies, the people who stole the secret of the atomic bomb and gave it to the Soviet Union. And that's what justified a death penalty for them both. The judge even said in sentencing them that they committed treason, even though that's not what they were convicted for. So you're absolutely right. They were charged with one thing and executed for another. And this is kind of like, you could say it was kind of a legal bait and switch in their case. And conspiracy is very important, to pick up on another thread of what you asked, because in order to prove a conspiracy, the government doesn't have to present a lot of tangible evidence. It's two or more people getting together and planning to do something. So there's a lot of oral testimony. It is the testimony of alleged co-conspirators, those who agree to cooperate with the government in exchange for a lesser sentence, who often become the chief prosecution witnesses. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is kind of suspect evidence, but it was the evidence that was presented in my parents' case.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Robert Mirapol, whose parents were executed in 1953, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. There are some people around these days who may not be familiar with the case, but it was huge. I can barely remember it. I was, I guess just two at the time, but I remember something awful that my parents were really concerned about. And it's just horrible, really, but it was part of the period of time. And I do want to talk about the period of the time, but also sticking with the focus on the charge of conspiracy. I wonder how, to make the charge, to make the accusation that two or more people got together and talked, it's very, very difficult to prove it, I would think. And how do you provide a defense if there was nobody else there except these two people? And, I wonder what the status of these conspiracy charges is today in 2012.
Well, that's sort of one of the things that jumps out at me when I think about this particular milestone, the February 25th affirmation of my parents' conviction. Oftentimes, what happens in a conspiracy case is it comes down to credibility. One set of witnesses said there's conversations taking place, actions taking place that are designed to steal atomic secrets. And another set of witnesses said, no, these things never took place. What the climate of the times and who's making the accusations and any sort of evidence that can be presented to bolster the accusations then becomes critical. Now, in my parents' case, there was no physical evidence, but there were discussions of pieces of evidence, and that's really what the appeals court focused on. If I can take a little extra time and try to be a little technical about this, Bert. In order to prove a conspiracy, the government has to link all the conspirators together. And then once they do that, the actions of any one conspirator are binding upon all the others. It's kind of a prosecutor's dream. In my parents' case, what the government said was that there was an atomic scientist named Klaus Fuchs who stole valuable atomic information, and he had a courier named Harry Gold. And Harry Gold usually took information from New Mexico, from Los Alamos, where Klaus Fuchs was working on the Manhattan Project with other scientists building the bomb. And he brought it to the Soviet consulate in New York City. But on one occasion, instead, Harry Gold went to visit another person, a GI named David Greenglass, who was working. He was a machinist. He was an army sergeant building parts of the atomic bomb. And he and his wife were living in an apartment near the army base. And Gold said he went to that apartment and he picked up some material from David Greenglass. Now, David Greenglass is my father's brother-in-law.
Right.
My father, Julius Rosenberg, his wife, Ethel Rosenberg, Ethel Rosenberg's younger brother, David Greenglass, was working on the atomic bomb at Los Alamos. And so the Greenglasses had testified that my father had given David Greenglass a half of a Jell-O box top and said that the man who came to get the atomic secrets later on would have the other half. And both the Greenglasses and Gold testified that there was a code phrase that Gold would use to identify himself to Greenglass, and that code phrase would have my father's name in it. So when my parents' attorneys in their appeal said, wait a second, there's lots of testimony from Gold about meeting Fuchs and also that he met Greenglass, and there's lots of testimony from Greenglass that he met the Rosenbergs. After all, they were family members. Gold never testified that he met my parents. Fuchs never testified at all. So there was no link between Gold and my parents, and that's where my parents' attorneys tried to attack the conspiracy charge at its weakest link. But the appeals court said, wait a second. There was a Jell-O box top that was, the jury could infer that Julius kept one half and gave it to someone who gave it to Gold. And they both used, David Greenglass and Harry Gold both used the code phrase Julius in the recognition right. signal, and from those two bits of evidence, the jury was able to infer the connection between Gold and my father, and that's what the basis of their upholding the conviction was. Now, the reason I go through all this detail is that in the 1970s, when my brother and I had a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit and forced previously secret government documents into the public eye, we discovered that when Gold was originally interrogated, he said that he didn't use the name Julius, he used the name Ben in the code phrase. And Greenglass, in his initial confession, said that Gold used the phrase Dave, the name Dave in the code. And that finally there was a third FBI document in which the two of them were brought together, Gold and Greenglass, in which they agreed that maybe, perhaps, the name Julius was used in the code phrase. But they weren't at all sure about that. Well, 3 months later at the trial, they were sure.
Uh-huh.
So that piece of the link all of a sudden became weaker. And then finally, in 2010, one of the world's leading experts on the case, Walter Schneer, published a book in which he detailed how it was actually Ruth Greenglass, David's wife, who was charged with creating the code phrase and not Julius Rosenberg. So when once we found those things out, we now realize, 60 years too late,
yes,
that the two pieces of evidence that the appeals court based its ruling that the chain of conspiracy had not been broken, both evaporated. And that's what strikes me, that now we know that the very basis of the conviction being upheld, that there's really no basis whatsoever, and this was a judicial error. But of course, once you execute people, you can't take it back.
It's a little late.
And, you know, it's almost 60 years too late.
Yeah. We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Robert Meeropol, who has started the Rosenberg Fund for Children. We will talk about that a little bit later to make sure making something amazingly good out of something amazingly horrible. and about what happened 60 years ago, February 25th. And I, you know, it seems so obvious that David and Ruth Greenglass wanted to, of course, save their own lives, and along with Harry Gold, they wanted to save their own lives, and they had a clear motivation to lie. Was that not obvious at the time? I mean, it seems so blatant now.
Well, you know, it's the way the government, the way a lot of people rationalized that was they said, oh, how would a brother lie and put his sister in such mortal jeopardy? You know, that means there were people who said that he must be telling the truth because he's implicating his sister. I think that does not really hold up. That doesn't make that the logic of that doesn't hold up, because I think the way Greenglass could rationalize this, and I've had no contact with David Greenglass,
and
he's still alive, though my understanding is he has Alzheimer's disease and he's no longer really able to communicate very well, or at least consistently. He's almost 90 years old. But that David didn't necessarily think that my parents were going to do what they did. I mean, after all, the government came to David and Ruth Greenglass and it said to them, you face a capital charge.
Right.
And you can save yourselves. We'll make you a deal. Mm-hmm. You testify this way, and David will get a 10 or 15 year prison sentence, and Ruth won't even be indicted. They had two kids, just like my parents had two kids, and she couldn't get to stay home and take care of the kids. And that was the deal that the Greenglasses made. And this is public knowledge. There's nothing controversial about this. And the Greenglasses could have rationalized. They could have said, well, you know, we made this deal. The Rosenbergs will make the same deal. They're going to have the government gave them ample opportunity to cooperate, to say what the government wanted them to say. And the Greenglasses could say, well, if the Rosenbergs aren't going to take advantage of this opportunity, well, that's their problem, not ours. So I think that with 2020 hindsight, we can say, oh yeah, it's obvious these are untrustworthy individuals, but in the rationale of the early 1950s, and we really haven't talked about this that much,
my
the whole
question, yes.
McCarthy period and the anti-communist hysteria, it was just assumed that, you know, the government was saying that the Greenglasses and the Rosenbergs did this. They were all communists, and they were all members of the Communist Party, at least at one point or another.
Sure.
And therefore, they must be guilty.
Well, I did want to ask that as the next question. You know, I love the law. This justice is something extremely valuable. And there's the statue of justice, which is a woman holding the scales of justice blindfolded. That's important, to be blindfolded, to not be influenced by anything but simply weighing the facts of a case. It seems that in this case, the blindfold wasn't exactly there. The political context factored in heavily. I suspect you can talk a lot more about that.
Well, I mean, I think that that's an ideal of justice. And, you know, I've had a rather complex professional life. I worked as an attorney for several years. I've actually clerked for judges. I have a tremendous amount of respect for due process and the rule of law. But I also realize, and I think most of us do, that the ideal of blind justice is rarely achieved. That it's almost impossible for political influences to be kept out of the judicial process. And what you find is when you have the biggest political crises, when society is most frightened, when threats are at their worst, is essentially when the judicial process is most likely to be compromised. So in some ways, the time when we need blind justice the most is often the time when we have it the least. That's unfortunate, but it's a byproduct of of our nature. When we go into a political crisis, we're going to have an extremely hard time not taking that into account when we're dealing with criminal matters. And we see that over and over again, whether it be, you know, Bush v. Gore more recently, or whether it be the case of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. It was a time of anti-communist hysteria. The United States and the Soviet Union were vying with each other for which model of society would dominate the world. Mm-hmm. It was the Cold War, and powerful forces within the United States were saying that the international communist conspiracy was going to destroy us, and they had stolen our most precious secrets, the secret of the atomic bomb, and therefore we have to do everything we can to make sure that the culprits are punished. And that blinded people to the actual facts of the case, and led to a miscarriage of justice. And I think, you know, today in post 9/11 America, when we're dealing with terrorism cases, we are liable to commit the same kind of errors. And we find the public once again, unfortunately, willing to accept the lessening of legal standards in order to protect themselves because they're afraid of what might happen if they don't.
Well, one thing that comes to mind most immediately, I mean, there was the Chicago 8 trial where there was a similar charge of conspiracy to commit violence, I guess it was, back in at the Democratic Convention back in 1968. And nobody was executed. In fact, virtually all of the convictions were, in fact, overturned, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But conspiracy, it's so hard to... so much depends, I think, on the spirit of the times, for sure. You know, like the Chicago 8, they were the bad guys. There was violence in Chicago. Well, we got to pick somebody out. It couldn't be the police. Well, it turned out it was the police. It was found to be a police riot. Fast forward quite a bit to 2012... Bradley Manning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here is a guy, Bradley Manning, who is alleged to have, he was in the military, I think a private, who somehow got some information to Julian Assange, and they put it out on WikiLeaks and told the truth, actually leaked genuine documents that didn't put anybody's life in danger whatsoever. But my feeling now is the firestorm of intensity that there's been some leaked documents about how people in the government just want to do in Bradley Manning. I wonder if you can compare the times back then, 1952, to 60 years later in this whole Bradley Manning thing. How possible might it be that he get a fair trial? Or there are people who want to execute him.
Yeah, well, I think that actually I just saw things online this morning, a new release about this private security firm that there's a secret, and I don't know whether this is true or not, that according to this, there's a secret indictment of Julian Assange already in the United States, and that their whole plan is to get him and along with Bradley Manning. And of course, the conditions under which Bradley Manning were held for many, many months, in my opinion, amount to torture.
Yeah.
And the whole purpose was to break him, was, I think, to turn him into a David Greenglass, so he would testify against Julian Assange, because Julian Assange is considered the big leader. And that evidently didn't work, but they are talking about conspiracy charges against all of these people, and in particular against Manning, so that in some ways the charge against Manning it's very reminiscent of the charge against my parents. And again, it will be in this case, I think there's relatively little doubt that Bradley Manning actually, I mean, you know,
it does seem,
release the truth.
Yeah.
But the difference here is that the charge against my parents was that they gave this material to a foreign power, to another country, for it to take advantage of us. But in Bradley Manning's case, He was just exposing the truth to the world. It wasn't about helping any one country. It was about a concept that I think goes to the core of the nature of our system. You know, what people like Julian Assange and Bradley Manning are essentially claiming is that the people have the right to know what the government is doing in their name. That secrecy is anathema to democracy. And that if we can't, if we don't, if we have massive amounts of secrecy, then we can't make the people can't make informed decisions. Now, there are people who will say, well, if we don't have secrets, other people will know our secrets and they'll destroy us. What we find over and over and over again with these secrets is that they have almost nothing to do with actually protecting our national security. They have to do with covering up corruption. They have to do with covering people's bureaucratic prerogatives. They have to do with all sorts of dirty tricks and manipulation, and what they do is destroy democracy. There's a direct inverse relationship between the amount of democracy a society has and the amount of secrecy it has. The more secret it is, the less democratic it is. And we have been moving in that direction. So you could say that someone like Manning is a real democratic hero.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, you know, my parents' case is quite the same because, I mean, first of all,
I don't want to claim
that my parents were totally and completely innocent. They were, as far as I know, my father at least. My mother was just a housewife, but my father was involved in helping the Soviet Union defeat the Nazis during World War II. There was a sharing of technical information that was certainly illegal. It wasn't about the secret of the atomic bomb, but that sharing, of course, was part of a belief that this was good for the world.
Yes.
And in that way, it's kind of like Bradley Manning's case, but it's still connected to another government. In Manning's case, he's not connected to any government whatsoever, even though the United States would like it to be the case.
Yeah. It's fascinating, this whole Bradley Manning thing, that you know, you can substitute the word communist and terrorist. It's just different times. And the whole hysteria around communism and terrorism, I mean, both, you know, we did not want the Soviets to get the atomic weapon, but these, you know, Bradley Manning and Assange, as you say, they're not connected at all. But it seems like the same kind of intense kangaroo court kind of thing, you know, a serious, serious miscarriage of justice based purely on politics and the mood of the times. And you got to get somebody. It doesn't make sense except to nail somebody. You were about to say something, Robert.
Well, they want to. I mean, they try to use the word terrorism. They try to, you know, call. They want Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, these people to be considered sort of cyber terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I think the whole use of the word terrorism. They have. It's. I agree with you entirely. The word terrorism has been substituted for communism.
Same thing.
You know, if you want to look at it in the broadest terms, back in the 1950s, there was a very, very simple equation that was drawn, and that is that the international communist conspiracy was going to destroy our way of life, and therefore matters of national security had to take precedence over human rights and civil liberties.
Hmm.
That was what we had to do in order to save ourselves. Well, all you need to do with that equation is remove the word communism and substitute the word terrorism, and you have the current situation, and that is there's an international terrorist conspiracy that's out to destroy our way of life, and therefore matters of national security have to take precedence over human rights and civil liberties. That's the justification. It's the justification, and what the government wants to do is expand that concept of terrorism, expand it to include anyone from environmentalists to WikiLeaks, so that anybody who attacks corporate property is all of a sudden a terrorist. And you know, again, I think of terrorism as destroying human life. You know, clearly damaging property is illegal.
Right.
Malicious destruction of property, sabotage, whatever you want to call it. But if it doesn't involve threatening human life, I don't think it's terrorism.
That's true. Buildings and profits can't be terrorized.
Right. Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's the... I mean, under the current corporate definition of terrorism, the Boston Tea Party would be considered a terrorist act. And I don't consider the Boston Tea Party a terrorist act.
Oh, my goodness. It's funny, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. We are talking to Robert Meeropol about, well, what happened 60 years ago, February 25th, 1952, with regard to the prosecution, persecution of his parents, which ended in them both being put to death, And, you know, it's, governments want to blame somebody. They can't, you know, I wonder, I've never been able to answer this question. Is there any proof that the Soviets only got the atomic bomb from getting secrets from the U.S.? I mean, maybe the Soviets were able to make a bomb all on their own, but somebody had to be blamed, didn't they? Because they're not like us. They couldn't do it on their own. Do we know if they got secrets from somebody and that's how they weren't able to make a bomb?
Well, there are a number of theories about this. And there have been a number of books published, and my own belief on that is, from what I can tell, German-born atomic scientist Klaus Fuchs, who was a top-of-the-line, world-class scientist, who was a member of the British team at Los Alamos, actually provided the Soviet Union with blueprints of, I don't remember whether it was the Hiroshima bomb or the Nagasaki bomb, one of those bombs.
Wow.
Now, the Soviet Union was actually pursuing its own atomic program.
Sure.
But they were going in a different direction. And what they did was they continued on with the bombs that they were making, which turned out to be bigger and much dirtier. If you remember, those of us who are old enough to remember the above ground testing, and the Soviet Union was testing these massive atomic bombs back in the late 1950s, the United States was testing much smaller ones. They were different kinds. However, to go back to my original point, it seems what the Soviet Union did was, when they got the blueprint of this bomb, they immediately put on a crash course to build one, and then they tested it in September of 1949, just a little over 4 years after we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
And they tested it into tricking the United States into thinking that they had their own deterrent. The reality is, it's the only bomb they had, and they blew that up in order to fool the United States. In the meantime, they continued on with their own program, and it wasn't until a few years later that they actually successfully tested their own bigger, dirtier bombs. And, you know, and when I say dirtier, I don't mean to imply that there was anything about the American atomic bomb that was necessarily clean, but it was a matter of degree. So, and the United States swallowed it. They succeeded in fooling the United States into thinking during the Korean War that they actually had a nuclear deterrent, when they didn't. It wasn't, at least that's my, you know, it, as often happens, the truth is rather complex.
Right. Always.
And that is my understanding of what actually happened. That it turns out, you asked a question, a kind of either-or question. Did they do it by stealing it, or did they do it on their own?
The answer is both.
And the answer is both.
Right. Right. It's usually not either or. It's usually, in most cases, both and. I always think.
So, I mean, again, but that's based upon, I don't, you know, I don't I'm not the world's greatest expert on this, and someone might come along and present other evidence that would contradict something that I said. That's my understanding of the situation.
Well, Klaus Fuchs, if he was a key player in developing the bomb, how come he wasn't prosecuted? How is it known?
Well, he was prosecuted. He was sentenced in Britain because he was British to their maximum sentence, which was 14 years. And then after 8 years, he was exchanged for a British spy, and he went back to East Germany, where he became head of their scientific development program. So, and he died there, you know, many years later.
Wow.
So, you know, he spent, I think, 8 years in prison. And he actually did provide very valuable information. There were other atomic scientists as well. In fact, a number of the atomic scientists didn't believe in secrecy. They believed in international cooperation.
Right.
And you could say that, you know, one person's espionage is another person's international cooperation. The scientists understood that the general theoretical knowledge needed to build an atomic bomb was known worldwide, and that sooner or later other countries would do this, and that rather than going the secrecy route, which would never really work, and history has proved that to be the case as more and more countries have developed their own bombs, it would be better to focus on international disarmament and try to get everybody to get rid of the bomb. You know, right now, and this is kind of an aside, but we have a lot of talk about Iran getting the bomb.
Yes.
You know, and and my attitude is Iran shouldn't have the bomb, but neither should anybody else. The problem is not that certain countries have the bomb. The problem is that nobody should have the bomb.
Right. No, it just, and the military leaders of our country long ago realized that, I mean, in the early 50s, the political people felt, well, we don't need to worry about troops. We got the bomb. You know, that'll just take care of things. But, you know, strategically and tactically, it's just, you know, and I can just imagine, okay, supposing Iran eventually got the bomb, which would certainly still be years away, okay, they're going to bomb Israel and Palestine? I mean, the nuclear strike would not differentiate between their enemies and their friends. But, you know, and the bombs are all over the place. I mean, Israel has who knows how many bombs. They do for sure have the nuclear bomb.
Yeah, I think I want to go back to the United States and just say there's just something that really sticks in my craw about us being so high and mighty when we are the only people who's ever used the atomic bomb on another nation.
Absolutely. It is amazing and what was happening there. And, well, it just makes it easier. It was a lot easier than the firestorm bombing that they did of Tokyo before that. They just had one bomb. It was a lot easier. How high up in government was the prosecution of your parents? I mean, there was the whole mood of the time, which was, you know, an anti-communist hysteria. People were, I mean, fear was manipulated to, you know, serve certain interests. I wonder what you know about how high up in government the prosecution was. Was, for example, J. Edgar Hoover involved or anybody within the...
J. Edgar Hoover was certainly involved. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover... one of the things... I'll step back for a minute. One of the things that's remarkable about my parents' case, and this is because of my brother and my Freedom of Information Act, in part in the 1970s, it forced into the public eye several hundred thousand pages of secret documents. And because we have this information and we know about certain dirty tricks that were that took place, other researchers have been able to go in and on the basis of this gather more information, and there's been some stuff that's come out of the Soviet Union. And the grand jury, the transcripts of a good portion of the grand jury proceedings were released just a couple of years ago. So one of the things that's remarkable about my parents' case is how much information we have about it. And one of the things we have is a memo from J. Edgar Hoover recommending sentences. He wanted a death sentence for my parents' co-defendant, Morton Sobel, and he wanted Ethel, my mother, to be sentenced to life in prison because he didn't want a woman to be executed. but the judge went ahead and did something different. So we know it went up to J. Edgar Hoover. We know that the Attorney General was involved. We know that the President, first President Truman, and then President Eisenhower received memos. We know that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was involved in reconvening the court into special session to make sure my parents' execution would happen swiftly. All branches of government at the very highest levels were involved in my parents' case. And this is not, you know, some charge of some, you know, crazy radical person. This is based upon the government's own documents. It's very, again, for someone who wants to get involved in researching this, at Columbia Law School Library, there's a repository of hundreds of thousands of secret government files. I don't think there's anyone who's actually gone through every single one and done an exhaustive analysis of them. It's, you know, people have said to me, oh, I bet you've read them all. You know, what are you kidding? Read 300,000 pages? You know, and I've said to people, aside from the fact that I don't have the patience, even if I did read through them all and took careful notes, you know, maybe then I'd have 25,000 pages of notes. What good would that do me? Yeah. It's just, you know, there may be a team of researchers or someone who's a much better researcher than I am and much more patient than I am who could tackle this project. But to date, I don't think anybody really has.
It's been fascinating, you know, as you describe how high up, you know, political leaders were involved in prosecuting your parents, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. I'm reminded of President Nixon when he personally had this thing against John Lennon. I mean, it's so bizarre, and I wonder how often things like that happen, where a president or people really high up in the federal government, you know, step in and force the prosecution, which is so incredibly counter to what the notion of justice is supposed to be. I mean, I wonder, you know, if President Obama, you know, he's not been great on civil liberties and protecting people and transparency. He said he was before transparency, but he's actually been a lot tougher than other presidents have been on that. But I just wonder how this might be addressed, or if, I mean, is this just a situation that we're going to have to live with? You know, we have incredibly powerful despots who, you know, they get to have their way and prosecute people and kill people based on their whims. I mean, it sounds like that's a lot of what happened to your parents.
Yeah, well, I think that I mean, in Obama's case, of course, we do have his public pronouncement of Bradley Manning's guilt. You know, he actually said that, you know, he broke the law, so he has to pay. Well, you know, I don't know that that's the kind of personal targeting that, you know, Nixon did and that others have done, but it seems that when there are people stick their head above the crowd and they're getting a lot of attention, whether it be John Lennon or, Bradley Manning, and they are a threat to whatever policies the current administration is trying to do, the presidents tend to take it very personally. I mean, I think one of the reasons, I mean, we have to think about what are the motivations of people to go into politics and to move up the chain of command? It's so that they can get to do what they want. I mean, you know, people are people. This is not, you know, the kind of motivations and aspirations and psychological drivers that drive the average person, they're not all that different from people who reach the pinnacle of power. And anyone who's driven to reach that for that kind of power must like to use it. I don't think you get people in those kind of offices who don't really want to be there. That there's always a danger when you concentrate too much power in an individual's hands that they will become despotic. And of course, as more and more power has accumulated to the executive branch of our government, it becomes an increasing danger, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Yeah, you're right. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Robbie Meeropol about his parents' case. It just doesn't go away because it has never been resolved. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And I wonder, in an ideal world, which obviously being ideal is not going to happen, you know, putting aside political realities, could, you know, just on legal grounds, would reopening of the case or exoneration be unrealistic, just on legal grounds, about looking into government misconduct and perjury? Could this technically happen, even though it's politically impossible?
Well, technically, I think that Governor Michael Dukakis, at the 50th anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, issued a proclamation,
yes,
essentially saying not that they were innocent, but that the process was so perverted that we should remove their conviction. And I think in my parents' case, the federal government, and since it wasn't a state case like with Dukakis in Massachusetts, this was a federal case, it would take the Obama administration issuing a proclamation saying that a similar thing, not that my parents were innocent, but that the process was so perverted that at least their execution was wrongful. I think that because the charge against my parents was conspiracy to commit espionage, and I think because Julius Rosenberg really did conspire to commit espionage, though it wasn't about the secret of the atomic bomb, it still was during world, you know, it was still helping provide secret information to the Soviet Union during the 1940s.
Well, we wanted to defeat the Nazis, yeah.
Yeah, well, to defeat the Nazis, and, you know, there's information, too, that it shows that it might have gone on after the end of World War II, but there's also information to show that my mother was not involved, and that you could make a stronger case at this point for some sort of federal proclamation declaring that my mother's execution and conviction was wrongful, not that she was innocent. Now, that's technically possible.
Right.
And it would be an executive order rather than a judicial proclamation. So you wouldn't have a court case. You would, you know, have an executive pronouncement. However, you know, you raised the question, how politically viable is this? Well, clearly something like this is not politically viable in an election year. And given the fact that I don't think the Obama administration has been particularly good on issues of civil liberties and human rights, I think it's unlikely, you know, even if he gets reelected. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. So it is technically possible.
It would be a good thing. It would be a good thing. There's lots of, I mean, I wish the U.S. could have an apology for the genocide of the Native Americans. Will it ever happen? I don't know. It happened in Canada. Some say your parents were heroes. What? You're the child of these two people who were put to death, and you know you've had many, many years to think about that. Do you think that's an appropriate word, heroes?
Well, you know, this gives me a real good segue to talk about the Rosenberg Fund for Children.
Perfect.
Too.
Good.
You know, I think that, you know, my parents were faced with a situation in which the most powerful political entity on earth said to them, "We're going to kill you, and unless you cooperate," and that cooperation included naming the names of their friends who they were, you know, they were not, Julius Rosenberg was not like a professional spy, like somebody out of a James Bond movie. These were people who grew up in poverty in the Depression, the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and they came of age in World War II when the world was choosing up sides, and they decided they were going to do what they could to make the world a better place, to fight the Nazis, and if that included providing the Soviet Union with secret information, because they were scientifically trained, they weren't top-notch atomic scientists, but my father was an electrical engineer, he knew people who were scientifically oriented, who had technical degrees, he was going to do what he could to make the world a better place, to make it safe from the Nazi scourge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they went on to do. And the people they worked with were their friends. And here was the government saying, all you need to do to save your life is to say you were involved in stealing the secret of the atomic bomb, which they weren't involved in, and to say that, to name the names of your friends who were involved. Well, they refused to place other people in the same position that they'd been placed,
mm-hmm.
despite the fact that that meant that they could die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very heroic. Mm-hmm. I think that's an extremely heroic action. That's acting on principle. You know, this is, they did this following their beliefs, and I only wish that, you know, I would have the courage to act the same way if I were put in that position. But of course, none of us really know how we'd act until we were placed there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that defining them as heroic is appropriate. However, I think that the idea that they were politically pure, that they were innocent lambs who, you know, stood up for absolute black and white simple truth, no, it was more complicated
right,
than that.
Right.
They were political actors who did things, who may have made mistakes, but they acted with integrity nevertheless. And that's an important thing to understand about heroes. If the only people we consider heroic are those who are perfect,
yeah,
we're going to have very few heroes.
That's a good point. Well,
now that said, I do want to talk about the Rosenberg Fund for Children just a bit.
Yeah, and I did want to just mention, I highly recommend the book that you wrote, Execution in the Family. It's something you'll never forget. And that talks about how the Rosenberg Fund for Children was created. Take it, Robbie.
Okay, well, you know, I was a small child when my parents were arrested, and 6 when they were executed. And I was shuffled around different places. It was very hard. I was actually thrown out of the New Jersey public school system when I was 6 when people found out who my parents were. It was a very, very difficult time. And it took me until I was 43 years old, until 1990, when I figured out how to repay the people who rallied to my aid, Abel and Ann Meeropol and others. Our names were changed. A small trust fund was raised. We went to special camps, special schools. We were protected. And as a result, I think I grew up, I survived. And what I took from that was I realized that the only way I could really repay that generation was to start a foundation in my parents' name whose mission was to provide for the educational and emotional needs of the children of targeted activists in the United States. So kind of the short version is we look out for people, for young people today who are experiencing the kind of nightmare my parents experienced after their arrest. It's not like they're on trial for their lives. People who are arrested, people who lose their jobs, you know, it could be as simple as a union organizer being fired and blacklisted. It could be someone who refuses to fight in a war and ends up being in prison. It could be young demonstrators beaten up by the police. It could be all of these things. We provide now somewhere between $350,000 and $400,000 a year of support for children. I've, with the help of a lot of people, I've built this foundation from nothing, basically, to one that has given away more than $4 million in grants in our 20-year history. And we're continuing to do that work. And with the explosion of activism in 2011, I actually expect things to get a lot busier this year than they've been.
That's probably true. And, you know, you think about, okay, parents may have done things that were whatever, and they get in trouble, but they got kids. The kids are victims. The kids shouldn't suffer. And there is nothing else like the Rosenberg Fund for Children to help the kids. You talked about, I know we've talked before about, like, getting piano lessons and things that really are meaningful to these children, because they're completely victims. They did nothing wrong whatsoever.
And people can criticize the parents, can say, oh,
sure,
these people shouldn't do this because they have children. But, you know, parents go out to try to make the world a better place for their children.
Absolutely.
If the only people who engage in activism are going to be people who do not have common familial concerns, that's not necessarily the kind of activism we want. We need people like that to be trying to make our society better, because those are the people who, you know, they're thoroughly integrated. They have children of their own, and they want to make the world a better place for them, and that's a laudable goal.
Absolutely, and I will ask just briefly, what can we learn from the Rosenberg case that's important to our future now about the manipulation of fear and the abuse of the justice system? I suppose that could go on for an hour or so. But
well, I think you've taken us, and that the question itself provides part of the answer. I think we have to beware of people who tell us that we have to give up our freedom in order to protect ourselves. I read a very frightening statistic that 75% of Americans believe we should keep Guantanamo open. The idea that it's all right to torture people, that it's all right to detain people without trial, without charge, in order to protect ourselves, that is a very dangerous concept, and one that will come back to bite us and to harm us. People always say we have to balance the needs of freedom versus security. I say that's a false dichotomy. It's never been shown to me that we become more free or that we become more secure if we give up our freedom. Yes, we lose our freedom, but we don't become any more secure. We end up living in fear of our security forces, and we don't want to go there.
Wow. If people want to check out the Rosenberg Fund for Children, www.rfc.org, is that correct?
Yes.
www.rfc.org. Terrific. Well, and I urge listeners to check it out. It's an amazing thing. It's a wonderful thing. Thank you so much, Robert Meeropol, for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today. And I guess we're all trying to make the world a little bit better.
We'll do what we can. And thank you so much for having me.
Carry it on. Thank you so much.
You too.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Email me, Burt@BurtCohen.com.